Checking the volume. Thank you. Returning to the refrain this afternoon. And since the Buddha repeated himself with this refrain, I'll continue to repeat it, so I'll read it again. This time, I will take the liberty of changing the specific around the foundation, observing the body as a body, or mindful there is a body. I'm going to change the language to experience, to kind of try to meet all the foundations in one reading. One abides observing experience as experience, internally, or one abides observing experience as experience externally, or one abides observing experience as experience both internally and externally. Or else one abides contemplating experience as arising, or experience as vanishing, or experience as both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness that there is experience is simply established to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This refrain, to me, and in reviewing it over and over this week, is kind of speaking to me as the mind moving towards freedom, observing the entirety of experience internally and externally, and contemplating or observing the impermanent nature of that experience with an established, continuous mindfulness. The bare knowledge of experience as experience. Leading to the abiding, independent, not caught up in views or craving, and not clinging to anything in the world. I take this last sentence as, in a way, it's less instruction and more result. One abides independent, not clinging to anything in this world. There's a connection, not only here, but in other places in the suttas, between the recognition of the impermanent nature of experience and the mind releasing craving, letting go of clinging. There's a couple of instructions or quotes. This from the Majjhima 37. Whatever feeling one feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, one abides contemplating impermanence in those feelings. And then it goes on, kind of again exploring the trajectory of moving towards freedom. Contemplating impermanence in those feelings, contemplating fading away, cessation, relinquishment. Contemplating this way, one does not cling to anything in the world. That same phrase, one does not cling to anything in this world. When one does not cling, one is not agitated. When one is not agitated, one personally attains nibbana, freedom. And so here, this sets up or explores this phrase, one abides, not clinging to anything in the world, as a very close condition for freedom. So it's this last phrase of the refrain is pointing to the conditions that create the terrain or the understanding from which freedom can happen. Maybe we could say, using the Grand Canyon analogy, it's the last step before you get to the Grand Canyon. And so this connection between impermanence and freedom, and we've been exploring this a lot this week. In another place, it talks about this connection between kind of a set of words that very similar to the Upanisa Sutta, the Sutta on Transcendent Dependent Origination, connecting the seeing experience as it is to seeing the impermanent nature of experience. Seeing clearly that form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness is impermanent. One experiences disenchantment. Experiencing disenchantment, one becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. So again, this place of impermanence creating, the seeing of impermanence creating the conditions for the mind to begin to let go, to really release the clinging. So these words, disenchantment and dispassion, we've talked a little bit about those in the last few days, but I thought I'd take a little more time with them today. Because they are, when we begin to really take in the truth of impermanence, unreliability, uncontrollability, the not-self nature of experience, we become, we are seeing directly, we start to see directly that the ways in which we have been navigating our lives the strategies that we've been using to find what we think of as ease and peace and happiness, that they are, that we have been misinformed or kind of caught by the delusion of the strategies that we've been engaged with. Seeing the impermanent nature of experience exposes our habitual strategies as being not very reliable or useful strategies. And so this word disenchantment, I think it's a great word. You know, we become disenchanted with our habitual strategies. We see that we have been enchanted by the kind of delusion in those strategies telling us, or when we're in that place of believing those strategies as being helpful, like the wool is drawn over our eyes. We are enchanted by those strategies. And so disenchantment is a good thing. We are becoming aware of the underlying mistaken notions that we've been operating from. There's a quote by Bhikkhu Bodhi about this place of disenchantment. So he describes it like this. The Pali word for disenchantment, disenchantment is translating, is nibbida. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says, nibbida signifies, in short, the serene, dignified withdrawal from phenomenon which supervenes when the illusion of their permanence, pleasure, and selfhood has been shattered by the light of correct knowledge and the vision of things as they are. I love that description, the serene, dignified withdrawal. But this place of disenchantment, it's not like flipping a switch, you know, where suddenly there's this, oh, it's impermanent. Oh, I don't need to hold on the way I used to. There's a kind of a process we go through. Becoming disenchanted. Now, maybe perhaps the end stage of disenchantment, when we have been disenchanted, you know, once the mind has finally realized, oh yeah, the strategies really don't work. Maybe then that's the serene, dignified withdrawal. But boy, we fight it tooth and nail. We like our strategies. We can't fathom other strategies, and we really want them to work. And so when we see maybe once that they don't work, it's like, okay, didn't seem to work. Or I'm experiencing, you know, the ways in which I'm getting a bumpy ride following trying these strategies. But maybe next time it'll work. You know, so it's not just once in my experience. It's not just seeing it once. You know, seeing impermanence once doesn't seem to cut it. We have to see it over and over again. It's like we have to try our strategies from this way. Maybe this way it'll work. Nope, that didn't work either. Okay, how about from this side? Nope, that didn't work either. And so this the terrain of disenchantment, or of becoming disenchanted, I should say, it can feel kind of bumpy. You know? There's a lot of emotional kind of flavors in our relationship to deeply seeing impermanence and deeply seeing that our strategies don't work. Our habitual strategies don't work. And I think, it feels to me like those various emotional relationships that seem to arise as we kind of begin to really confront the impermanent, unreliable, not-self nature of experience. These different relationships kind of reflect kind of subtler and subtler or different ways of still holding on, believing that perhaps in some situations it might just be okay to cling. So I think that the process of disenchantment unfolds through looking at all of these different relationships that we have to seeing that our strategies don't work, seeing the impermanent nature of experience. We can feel like betrayed by the world, by our minds, Like, what? These strategies don't work? I'm sure that my parents told me these strategies would work somehow. Or the world has told me these strategies will work. So there can be a feeling of betrayal. A feeling of kind of loss of, like, you know, oh, almost homesickness. You know, we like those strategies. They feel pretty cozy and comfy. And you know, it's like we lose a home. It can feel like homesickness sometimes, this relationship to seeing impermanence, unreliability, that our strategies aren't useful. We can experience fear, sometimes even as strong as terror, in really meeting this unreliability. Sometimes it can just be boredom. Like, yep, things are coming and going. Yep, still coming and going. Is it ever going to stop? No, it seems like it's just going to go on forever. So there can be a boredom or a sense of not wanting to practice or a sense of just disinterest. Like, yeah, I've seen this many times. How many times do I have to see this? There's a lot of different relationships that the mind goes through in this process of unhooking from its usual ways of relating to experience and seeing how those strategies don't fly very well in the face of impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable experience. But these relationships, actually seeing these relationships, and we talk about this a lot, right? I keep encouraging you, notice how you are in relationship to experience. When your strategies kind of feels like the rug has been pulled out from you and the strategy doesn't feel like it's working and there's this feeling of like betrayal or homesickness or disgust, like, what's going on here anyway? That relationship is reflective of a kind of a subtle clinging to wanting those strategies to be workable. And that observation of those emotional kind of flavors in this terrain of disenchantment, that is how the path deepens. We don't somehow seem to, like, magically, you know, hover up over all this suffering and transcend and just fly over it. We really have to kind of massage the experience through meeting it. And some of that meeting is these relationships. Meeting these relationships as we become disenchanted with our usual ways of navigating the world. So the mind moves in the direction. So that's the disenchantment. I'll read that sentence again. Seeing clearly that form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness are impermanent. One experiences disenchantment. Experiencing disenchantment, one becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. And so the becoming thoroughly disenchanted with our strategies moves us in the direction of dispassion. We talked a little bit about dispassion the other day. I believe in the hall we talked about that, you know, dispassion basically means it's the dispassion around greed, aversion, and delusion. It doesn't mean that we become unfeeling. So sometimes that word, the use of the translation dispassion for the Pali viraga, it can land in a kind of a way that, like, I don't want to be dispassionate. I want to care. And I would just say that this place of practice, the dispassion, is a about letting go of the processes in the mind that actually get in the way of caring. Greed, aversion, delusion, all kind of buffer us from really directly meeting the nature of experience internally and externally, and kind of keep us from kind of put a shell around our heart, our experience, and keep us from really connecting intimately with experience. And so this dispassion is a kind of a releasing, or the word actually viraga means fading away. And I like that actually, because it's used in terms of, in a more ordinary way, apparently it's used in terms of a cloth or the fading of dye in a cloth. And so that image, I think so much the Buddha teaches in images and analogies, and they evoke so much. We can learn so much by kind of massaging the images. And so he's essentially using a metaphor at this point in the practice, that through disenchantment there's a fading away of greed, aversion, and delusion, and releasing of that dye in the cloth. And that's a slow process. You wash a cloth that has dye in it with soap, and some of the color comes out with the soap. You sit it in the sun for a while, let it dry. Some of the color lifts with the bleaching in the sun. But it's a slow process. It's a gradual fading. And so the process of dispassion also strikes me as a process, not that, like, again, there's this kind of wish or thought that, oh, if I see impermanence, suddenly I'll be disenchanted and then suddenly I'll be dispassionate. But the whole description of the path is one of gradual wearing away. I talked about the analogy of the rope, the rigging of the ship, gradually wearing away. That's that kind of the fading of the ways the mind craves and clings, is caught by greed, aversion, and delusion. And so over the course of practice, it's kind of like different levels of fading happen. The early levels of fading are probably the major reactivities that we have kind of conditioned into our lives. These big kind of habits and patterns that we feel often very caught by. For me, self-hatred, one of those. Just that real struggle and suffering. So the big ways that we suffer, the practice seems to first meet that level of struggle and suffering. And over time, and again, a gradual fading and releasing, and this process, we know this process. Sometimes we have a measure of kind of release from a pattern for a while, but then it comes surging back and we get to look at it again. So even this, it feels like in experience, it doesn't feel like there's a gradual, slow, continual fading of the dye. It's almost like it feels like the vat of dye is sitting right there, and like we take that cloth and dump it right back in the vat, and then we go through the process again. But I don't know that that's actually what's happening. Maybe it's more like, you know, in this experience of meeting particular patterns, we learn something about a part of the pattern, and there's a kind of a releasing in a particular area, but another time another aspect of the pattern comes charging out. And so maybe it's like we've washed one part of the cloth with soap and it's faded that part, but there's another part that's like ready and waiting. So the process of fading, maybe it's an uneven fading. And so sometimes we experience a surge of the reactivity, and yet there is this gradual process of weakening our reactivity, our deep habits and patterns. And then maybe there's kind of we land in a place where the bigger patterns have let go, at least largely, and we're in a place of just so much more ease and peace in our lives. And for a time, I described this process the other morning, for a time it can feel like, you know, the ease and peace of having lost or let go of a certain kind of major suffering. It's like this major kind of shell or layer of suffering has kind of fallen away. And there's so much ease in that. And that may be where we hang out for a while. But then, over time, we start to see, oh, that the habit of aversion is still there for me. And this is definitely the main habit, one of the big ones that I worked with, I've worked with. And so the self-hatred can fall away, but there's still this aversive mind that just kind of gets real grinchy and doesn't like things, and wants things to be different. And so that then is where the attention begins to meet experience. There has been a fading away, a releasing of certain layers of major reactivity, but then we start to see subtler levels of reactivity. Now, this is a gradual process. The Buddha talked about this in his own practice. Different kinds of fading away of kinds of attachments. I abandoned craving for sense pleasures. I remove the fever for sense pleasures. I abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. I see other beings who are not free from lust for sense pleasures, being devoured by craving, burning with fever for sense pleasures, and I do not envy them. Why is that? Because there's a delight apart from sense pleasure, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior. And so this speaks to kind of a letting go of the attachment to sense pleasure. And then he speaks about concentration, and divine bliss is the words that, you know, kind of the state of concentration. He went through the practice of concentration early in his renunciate life, and recognize that, while it feels pretty good, you know, this is not the freedom I'm looking for. But that too, we can just be attached to. And so, you know, the kind of the letting go of attachment to that, we can cling to the Dharma. You know, we can, and this is a part. It seems to me to be a part of how the fading away happens. The clinging releases around the most gross, kind of coarse forms of unwholesome states. That's kind of the first level of release. And then there's subtler unwholesome states. And sometimes we may like in this process of letting go of the, in the process of working or exploring, letting go of major reactivity, we may construct a kind of an identity or a clinging around holding on to the practice. That may be kind of what happens there. And, you know, that kind of clinging there is actually a support for helping us let go of the more, the coarser kind of reactivity and clinging. And yet, at some point, and this is, I think, part of that description of, you know, when the bigger kinds of cravings and clingings are released, there's an experience of peace, of ease for a while, and then some subtler kinds of clingings may be revealed, and one of those may be the identity of being a practitioner. That, at that point, there may become the sense of, oh yeah, that, oh, there's a tension, there's a tightness there that wasn't necessarily like very obvious when we were exploring letting go of the major reactivity. The fact that there's a little bit of tension and tightness around identifying with being a meditator is a smaller kind of clinging or craving. But at some point, when the bigger reactivity is released, those subtler forms of craving begin to be seen. And so it's not like a problem. It's just kind of, in a way, it's like staged releasing. This dispassion, I think of, is like it helps us to let go in stages. So there's this fading away aspect of dispassion. And then there's this kind of aspect of letting go. That comes with dispassion. There's a definition of freedom in the suttas. This is peaceful. This is the sublime. That is the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. So this phrase or description of freedom kind of uses a couple of similes, essentially, for nibbana, including dispassion. This is the peaceful, this is the sublime, the stilling of all formations, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. So this phrase gives us a little bit of another kind of pointing around what happens with freedom. But it's a letting go, the relinquishing of all attachments, the ending of craving. Freedom is not about getting anything. Another definition of freedom is the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. The non-arising of greed, aversion, and delusion. It's not about anything in particular acquired. It's not acquiring anything. It's entirely about releasing, letting go. So dispassion can also be understood at a certain point, not as the fading, that part, but as simply the non-arising of craving, the non-arising of desire, of greed, of aversion, of delusion. I often use this example, but it's useful, I think, to help us just remember and get a flavor or a taste about what the non-arising is. What that kind of, you know, how can we get a sense of what it means to know the non-arising? It's subtle. You know, we don't usually recognize when things aren't here. But we maybe can feel into this a little bit, you know, thinking back, you know, just let yourself recall, you know, what your favorite toy from childhood was. Maybe, you know, when you were about 4 or 5 years old. What was your favorite toy, the one that you carried with you everywhere? You know, I had this teddy bear that all the fur got rubbed off of it, and the eyes, the button eyes were gone, and I still carried this teddy bear everywhere. It was a beloved teddy bear. There was clearly attachment, you know, enchanted by the teddy bear. But, you know, as we age, you know, it may be that we begin to lose interest in that toy. You know, we age, we grow, there's a changing of our minds as we grow. We lose interest in things. And so this is that flavor of disinterest that comes with disenchantment. You know, we find it's not satisfying us in the same way anymore, and so we begin to leave it behind, or we forget about it. You know, and then we come back in the room and it's like, oh, there it is, I've missed you, teddy bear. You know, so kind of that kind of attachment comes and goes, and we, you know, maybe we secretly have the kind of attachment to the teddy bear only when we're not with our friends, you know, because we begin to see that our friends don't think it's very cool to be carrying a teddy bear with you everywhere. So, you know, there's this kind of process by which we let go of that. And some of that's the disenchantment, and some of it is the fading aspect of dispassion. So the disenchantment is like this process of losing interest. It's, we slowly start to see it's not as enjoyable as it was. Our mind has shifted. It's not satisfying us in the same way, this joy. And one lets go. It's just not interested so much anymore. But as an adult, you know, how long has it been since you even thought about that toy? That's the flavor of non-arising. You know, the process of losing interest in the toy. It's like we just get, it's like it's not so interesting anymore. We're just not so interested in carrying it around with us. But there's still a kind of a relationship, the relationship of disinterest. But, you know, as an adult, it's like interest, disinterest, it's not even relevant. And that's that real, like the, we don't even think of picking up that toy. It's just not relevant to us. That's that place of dispassion, of the mind that understands so thoroughly those strategies that it doesn't even think of picking them up anymore. And that's that place where the mind can let go, has the letting go into freedom. I mentioned this morning, I think it was this morning, that Nibbana is sometimes described or named as the unconditioned. And I want to read a quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi who uses that word, so I wanted to remind you of that that's what's being referred to here, this freedom, Nibbana, realizing the unconditioned is what the phrase Bhikkhu Bodhi used. Though the realization of the unconditioned requires a turning away from the conditioned. It's kind of like that recognition of just not interest in the picking up. The realization of the conditioned requires a turning away from the conditioned. It must be emphasized that this realization is achieved precisely through the understanding of the conditioned. Nibbana cannot be reached by backing off from a direct confrontation with samsara, to lose oneself in blissful oblivion to the world. The path to liberation is a path of understanding, comprehension, and transcendence, not of escapism or emotional self-indulgence. Nibbana can only be attained by turning one's gaze towards samsara, towards suffering, and scrutinizing it in all its darkness. The understanding of the conditioned is the way to the unconditioned. Suffering is a supportive condition for freedom. Meeting suffering, understanding it with mindfulness and wisdom, that is a supportive condition for freedom. So in these descriptions of freedom, the relinquishment of attachments, the freedom from craving, the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion, many, many places where freedom is described. It is described in these terms about what's not here, the absence of, not what is attained. So that kind of sense of freedom not being about getting anything. It is the relinquishment of attachments, of craving. And so that's the description of freedom. What's the expression of freedom in the world? You know, those descriptions of non-attachment, of letting go, of release. You know, our mind, when the mind is embedded in the delusions that are inherent in the greed and the aversion. You know, that those delusions, like the getting, the having, the getting rid of, that is the best strategy for living life. You know, the having, the getting rid of, it's like that strategy is so deeply ingrained that in hearing some of these descriptions, you know, the mind that is looking at experience from that perspective and hearing the description that freedom is not about getting anything, it's about letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion, it's like we can feel bereft. It's like the, you know, If the mind isn't getting something, then it's just going to sit there like a lump on a log. Like, why would I do anything if I didn't want to do anything? That's what wanting tells the mind. Wanting tells the mind, you have to follow me because otherwise you won't do anything. Aversion says, you know, something similar in a different flavor. Those are the delusions embedded in there. That perspective cannot fathom any motivation other than the needing to get something. The needing to have and construct and hold on to. And it does take some trust, I think, too. trust that that letting go doesn't leave us in a kind of a zoned out zombie-like state. But it doesn't lead us in a zoned out zombie-like state. As I kind of described earlier, it's like those patterns, they are kind of buffering us and kind of keeping us from direct contact and relationship with the world. And when they fall away, other motivations seem to come to the fore. Motivations based on wisdom, on compassion, on love, generosity. When greed, aversion, and delusion fall away, mental formations don't stop, but greed, aversion, and delusion, mental formations do stop arising. And so the intentions that arise in our minds are connected with wholesome qualities. And my understanding is that for like the Buddha, this wasn't something that he had to do. This is the nature of the mind that has let go of greed, aversion, and delusion. It acts out of the welfare for all. And so I like to reflect. You know, sometimes I remember some of the most free beings I've met. And you know, I don't know whether any of them were completely awakened, but some of them are pretty free. And, you know, they're really different. One monk in the Sagaing Hills, youngish, I think he's probably under 50. His expression is such tranquility that it's palpable walking into his monastery. I feel like I was like walking into his mind, walking into the monastery, walking into that, surrounded by tranquility as I walked into the monastery. Another, just endlessly laughing, delighted, joyful. So, there's a lot of room for personal, like, expression. We all have our own, like, unique beingness. And it's not like we all become the same when greed, aversion, and delusion fall away. Like, there's different expressions of freedom. What might be your expression? You know, some beings may want Sayadaw Ujjayanta in the Sagaing Hills. His expression was sitting in stillness in his monastery. Gandhi, a very free being, I think. His expression was acting in the world. But there's a lot of room for, with the non-arising of greed, aversion, and delusion, there's a lot of room for how freedom can express itself. And that delights me. Sometimes the phrase that I think this was something the Buddha said to Ananda, be a lamp unto yourself. Each lamp unique. Shedding light in the world, in its own way. And this freedom is possible . The Buddha encouraged us . He said, "It is possible. If it weren't possible, I wouldn't ask you to do it." And the simple mind seems to be the mind that can open to freedom. We don't know what freedom is. Maybe we get little tastes here and there, little hints when we experience for a moment the releasing of an attachment and feel that freedom, that releasing. We get little like hints or reflections of it. But we can't really know what it is. We can't be looking for it. But that simple mind that just meets impermanent experience, understanding it as impermanent, unreliable, not self. That mind can be available to open to the unconditioned. The Buddha had a number of analogies for Nibbana, and two of them, the subtle, the very hard to see. And we can't see it or find it by looking for it. It's more like the gift of the release, the gift of that. Independent abiding, not clinging to anything in the world.